we're trying to describe something and we're doing it through, so turning towards a metaphor. We're trying to describe something and we're doing it through a sort of image of movement. I mean, meta's got a few different movements to it. It has an opening's another movement. Maybe radiance is a sort of another movement as well. So, but it's not a literal turning of self necessarily, although it might be if you meet a person. It's just trying to get at that sense of at least not pushing away, at least not aversion. Yeah, so it could almost be like a movement, a metaphor action might be almost a non action sometimes, if you see what I mean. Might be a not pushing away at something. But it's just one aspect. It's just one aspect of metta. So in a way, because it says the next part of the question, what's the nature of turning towards? Well, in a way, I'm saying it is a metaphor. It's a metaphor of movement. But it's just what we're trying to get at is, the way you might incline your being or very slightly tilt towards something as a manner of expressing openness or interest or sensitivity or care, any of those things. So that's sort of what we're trying to talk about. And for some reason, I just got this image of a garden and just like... just trying to get the sense of matter as being this, it's a huge subject, and matter, I'd say it's like a garden, and that image of turning towards a direction is a little bit like trying to say, well, the plants grow towards the sun, which is true, there's a sort of direction there, but it doesn't actually tell you the nature of the garden. Yeah, it's just one aspect of the garden, if that makes sense. I'll leave that one there.
So, it was another question.
Do you want me to do the next one?
Yeah.
Okay, I'm going to talk about that. So this question was, in any one period of metta meditation practice, I often find myself drawing upon feeling elements of all four Brahma Viharas. Do you have any thoughts on this? So again, I think this was just, in a way, I think drawing out this sense of the vastness of metta, or the, it's like it underpins just about every positive emotion, doesn't it? Maybe it does underpin every positive emotion. So, and it changes flavour depending on what it comes into contact with. It changes flavour. So if it comes into contact with any sort of unpleasant Vedana, it will probably turn into compassion. If it comes into contact with any positive Vedana, you get mudita. Yeah.
Can you say that?
Sorry?
Can you say that almost a bit again?
Any positive Vedana, you get mudita, sympathetic joy. But it can also blossom into gratitude, faith. In a way, I suppose I just see it's kind of like the I think metta is like the cloth of all positive emotions, and it's going to take on lots of different flavours, and it just depends what it's connecting with. I think that's all I probably need to say with that one. So in a way, of course it's going to flare in different ways. If you're sensitive to what's arising in your experience that you're bringing metta to, then you might notice lots of different nuances and shifts. Yeah.
You're looking at me.
No, she was looking at me, but I'm looking at you.
Okay.
That's it, yeah.
So from images
for story.
Quite a question.
Yep. Okay, so the question, please remind me of the point of understanding emptiness and no self in practical terms. How does that actually help us move towards enlightenment? Great question. Yeah, so, well, firstly, what is enlightenment? I don't know that I have the answer to that. I certainly don't feel like I've experienced it, but I feel like I can recognise, and we probably can all recognise, the qualities of that experience. So I'd like to tell a story. I know someone in this room has heard this story before, so apologies. I was door knocking for Karuna, which is, in a way, it's an interesting thing to do. It's not an easy thing to choose. And part of the conditions, so you're knocking on people's doors, you're uninvited, and you're entering into people's lives. So almost instantly you're meeting difference, and at times you're meeting aversion. So it's like you're choosing to enter into those conditions. And one of the important conditions that I try and do, or I encourage other people that are learning how to do it, is to meet, or to, before you knock on each door, is to try and remember to be open to whatever you meet. White Tara helps with this. So anyway, I was in Manchester and I knocked on a door. And then I looked at this bay window and there was this sign and it said, hawkers, religious fanatics, charity workers and something else, knock and feel my wrath. And as I finished and saw that last line, the door opened. And in a way what I met, so this is rare, don't let this put you off. This is still my best door, even though it wasn't easy. And what I met was, well, it didn't even feel like a human being. It felt like this being that was full of darkness and rage and anger and hatred. And he opened the door, he looked at me. So self-preservation kicks in and I just think, oh, so right now I've got two options, I run or I stay. Unfortunately, the previous conditions, knocking each door with mindfulness and metta, had created enough space for me to feel that fear arising in my body, and I just connected with it and felt the fear and just connected to the ground, took a breath, and then I said to him, had I read this sign, I would not have knocked on your door. So I was trying to just reassure him I wasn't trying to dig. And he looked at me and he, through gritted teeth, just said, I don't like people knocking at my door. And he sort of spitted it at me. And something happened in that moment. I sort of took him in and I took those words in. And I took a breath and somehow I created enough space to be able to contact my heart, and what I saw wasn't my aversion and this man being mean to me. I just had this experience of this man, from all the conditions I have no idea that he's come from, this is him being kind and generous. Mm-hmm. Although, you know, my normal experience of kindness and generosity didn't quite look like this. But I really could see that was him really doing his best. Mm. And something happened. It's like my heart opened again to him. And I looked at him and I just said, I know, because at the end of what he said, and that's the kindest way I've ever said that. That's the nicest way I've ever said that. And then I recognised that he was being kind. And something changed. My heart opened. And I just said, thank you. And I just met his offering of kindness. And something happened in that moment. It's like he just melted and softened. And tears welled up in his eyes. My heart opened. And then I just said, thank you, because it's really not easy doing this. And so I kind of met, I brought myself in there, you know, and I stayed open. And then he just slammed the door and went. And, you know, I turned around and just felt like that is the best door I've ever knocked on and the strongest experience of metta that I feel like I've had. And even though it wasn't easy, so there's something in feeling myself wanting to contract and defend and protect, which is, of course, might be necessary at times, but somehow I'd created enough space to be able to just see that this man wasn't doing this to me. Mm. He was this product of whatever conditions, I've got no idea what had caused that pain in him. And I was able to relate to that rather than fixing him into this horrible man who was angry. Yeah. So that's the story that I want to share. So that's the point. You know, we're trying to relate to each other. I mean, that's the way I see it in a way. It's like relate to our own experience and relate to each other on that basis, not fixing ourselves, not fixing each other. Yeah. So how does seeing that help us lead to enlightenment? Well, that is it, isn't it? That's the path that you're doing it. You're kind of those little moments of trying to stay open, where there's equanimity, where there's love, where there's kindness. They are all the qualities of awakening that you're just recognizing more and more, and that's who you'll become. Yeah. I think that's my response. Thanks for the question. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
My response is sadhu.
Yeah. Oh, the other thing actually I wanted to say is, you know, this is an individual thing and I don't think everyone should do an appeal. It's more like there's something about, you know, not protecting yourself from experiencing an edge where you meet that. Otherwise you're just, you know, it's kind of like you'll never stretch into something more. Whether that's in meditation or in the world, it's like just, you know, we can all be so much more than we think we are.
Want to add to that? It's such a good story, isn't it? So the only thing I wanted to say was just that I was talking to Deben, who led a sort of symposium on self and no self at Adisthana the other month, and saying, so, you know, well, where did you get to collectively? What did you come up with? What was the answer? And he was saying, well, where we got to is like whatever the teachings are about self or no self, and I think we could include emptiness in there, the only point is so that you come into relation with the world, with beings. That's the point of it. It's not a point, it's not a thing in itself. It's simply informs the way in which you turn towards the world. Which is just a less exciting way of saying what's going on when it's just the
same thing.
But
yeah.
Yeah. Is it you, Deirdre?
So, on this same question, what's the point of understanding emptiness and no self, practical terms? I also wanted to share a bit of personal experience. I've worked with a sort of core samskara that I call basic badness. A sense that there is something in me that is bad. And there we have it. The view that emptiness is trying to uproot, the view that there is some essence, which in this case is perceived as bad, and is there, that's a painful view. And I have found that nothing has quite cut through that like really seeing, exploring emptiness, the emptiness of self, and looking these things that I'm identifying as me bad. Where are they? These thoughts, actions, volitions, perceptions. How can they be me? Dependent on conditions, arising out of conditions, not permanent, continually, you know, nothing continuous there. So, yeah, that's really, it's really, that's really sort of cut it like no other practice for me. And I still, it's not like I don't get those thoughts, or I don't get those, you know, that filter on my perception where I'm looking for things that prove, oh, there it is, you know, you did that bad, you know. But there's, it brings a way of, a possibility of a way of looking and a remembering that can't be found. Not something that can be found. So, next question. Diyajyoti, did you say everything is relational? That's emptiness. Could you please go over how you got there? So, thank you for checking out whether I said that. And no, I didn't say that. I did say something very close to that, but importantly and subtly different. I said one way of talking, I either said talking or thinking about emptiness, is to say everything is relational. And so the important difference there is it's not kind of saying this is emptiness, which would be a singularity of view, which, as we know, is what Maitri Devi does not like. With very good reason. So fixing. Yeah, Vanti talks beautifully about view and how it needs to be held lightly in Guide to the Buddha's Path. So, everything is relational. We're up against the limitations of language. It's more that there is only relationship or relating. It's not that this is related to that. I am related, you know, self is related to other. Or it's more that there's only the relating or the relationship. It's not that there's this and that interconnected. It's just that there's only connection or a co-arising. It's a bit like when Bhante says, it's not that things are changing, things are constantly changing. It's that life, it's deeper than that. It's that there are no things. It's that life is change. There is only the change. So we're up against this problem of finding language. emptiness is pointing to how nothing is graspable and can be pinned down, and that's true of emptiness itself. So, you know, you have to find what resonates for you. I really like this thing from Thich Nhat Hanh that points to emptiness, but for some people it might sound really heady, but he says, a Sangamani consists entirely of non-Sangamani elements. Sangamani can't be found separate from the conditions that form this emerging arising. So the reason why it's so difficult to find words to evoke emptiness, conditionality, the middle way, is that all of our language is kind of, it's not geared up to it. It's all not quite right. So we assume these dualities like one or many, same or different, separate or one, exists or doesn't. You know, it's this thing or it's not this thing. And the middle way is transcending all of those. So there's just relationship, there's just this co-arising of conditions, co-forming, co-creating. And so examples, which Maitri Levi mentioned, doing the practice, the third phase practice, in relation to the breath or in relation to walking. So with the breath, can you find the breath separate from its conditions? Can you actually find the breath? Or if you look, is there just these, can you find it separate from the body, experience of the body, or the awareness that's perceiving it? Can you find walking? And this is something that's really interesting to look at in walking meditation. Can you find something that you can pin down in time or space as walking, separate from air, space, body sensations, legs, all of that? And you might think that's all a bit abstract, but what's really interesting is that there is a subtle dukkha in that making a thing, is a kind of clinging. We're making it an object that I am experiencing. So we're making it an object, and in that we're making the me, the self, and the subject, who's separate. So separating from, it's creating that perception of separation. So even just the sense of, you know, if you've, there's a strong relationship, an opposition, this is my enemy, there's obviously strong clinging, craving and aversion, but it gets much, much more subtle, so that even the sense of I'm the experiencer experiencing this thing that is not me, rather than just being the walking, being the breath. And it's really interesting to notice, where I found this with the walking or the breath, how when you can let go of that sense of a me doing something or experiencing something, there's a subtle kind of release there. Something to explore. Ooh. So, another question. Midway through this retreat, whilst meditating on emptiness, suddenly and unexpectedly, I felt I could understand the universal reality of this state or condition. I was suffused with positivity, expansiveness, and awe, and I went on to try and work out the ramifications in my life of this new insight. Within 36 hours, the warmth and light of this experience had faded, and within 2 days, it felt like my heart was more like a stone, i.e. inactive. Do you have any advice about how I might have better protected myself and absorbed and assimilated such a strong experience? So there's a lot in there, and I think it relates to vision and transformation. That's how Bhante talks about it. Strong experiences arise, and then they need to be integrated, and that takes time. Things that can help are not holding on to the initial experience, although sometimes remembering that experience, evoking it, feeling it, remembering it in the body, how it was in the body, that it can help. Just giving it space, just sitting is really good. Just allowing space for that experience without trying to do anything with it or think it through or grasp at what it means or really get a kind of coherent take, just allowing it to really suffuse the being. And absorption can really help without even necessarily bringing it in a big way, just settling the being as much as you're able to. So I want to say a little bit about this. There's a review and perception aspect we talked about before. So there's a shift in view in how we understand things, and then it brings a shift in perception. Maybe there's a sense of there are no boundaries or something like that. But that's a shift in perception, independence on conditions. It's a passing experience. What matters is the understanding, the shift in the view, or that's what will endure. Experiences come and go. And a lot of the times we can have sort of big expansive experiences and think that that's it, rather than it's what it's pointing to. So for example, you might have an experience in meditation where there's a real lessening of the sense of self, there's a real loss of boundary, of the sense of expansiveness and so on. Can it be seen in that the normal perception of boundary and self contained is just a perception dependent on conditions? Can we see the emptiness rather than just thinking that the experience is it? Maitreya, do you want to add anything? If you do, I'm going to bring the mic up.
Well, that's something like slightly tangential, but something spot on.
So this is a tangent actually, but it was just it got me thinking about leading and trailing edges, and it got me thinking about big experiences and not big experiences, because some people have big experiences, lots, and some people don't have any, and can feel quite bad about that. You know, they can feel. Wouldn't it be lovely to be able to ask that question? So I just want to say our psyches just seem to be very different, and I think some people have like their leading edge, so to speak, is way out there, and sometimes their trailing edge is way back there, and they can have these, you know, massive experiences, but there's a huge amount to get integrated as well. And other people, it seems like maybe the leading and the trailing edge are very close, and so it's kind of like they might be having, you know, important spiritual understandings, but it won't necessarily feel like a huge
because actually their psyche's fairly of a piece. It also doesn't, I'm also not saying that if you have a massive experience, your psyche's all, you know, all over the place. But, you know, I'm just trying to, you know, in a way, it's just one way of thinking about, one way of imagining it, that you don't have to think that everything's about the big experience, I suppose. Mm-hmm. And then just the other thing, I suppose, about, you know, if you do have that sort of experience, patience. I mean, I do think that in terms of allowing experience to suffuse the psyche, I'm saying the same thing in slightly different language to Dajoti, to sort of suffuse the psyche takes time. And I think, like Dajoti said, you can, there's a difference between grasping it and then just returning to the experience and recollecting it in the body. That can be a non-grasping, but it's quite important. And, you know, it takes years. Well, I might be very slow, but I don't know. But my experience is that I have to give myself years sometimes just to feel like I've worked something through. And my, and in a way, it's not how big the experience is, to my mind. It's how deep you can get it into your being. Mm. You know, you wanna be having it coming out through your pores in some way. So what does that mean? How do you bring it right down into the depths? Or back to the trailing, you know, how does that trailing edge kind of get touched? Yeah.
So sparked by that, I want to add one little extra thing, which is that it can really help to find somebody to talk to about those experiences. Sometimes there are weird views around this, that it's sort of, you shouldn't talk about insight experiences, or it's boasting or something like that. My experience and talking to lots of people is that we need to talk to the right person who's really going to be able to receive us and support us, or point us to somebody else who can. Really important. And if the ego is appropriating an experience to some extent, that's just what happens. Doesn't mean it's just another Mara manifestation. Doesn't mean we can't, shouldn't stop us from being able to talk about the experience anyway. So there's been a little extra question about absorption. Oh, let's have yours next and then we'll come.
What time do we stop?
We're going to stop at 11:40 at the very latest. We've still got time.
I don't think I want to say very much because I don't think this is practice, but it was.
Could you hold on one sec, Matt?
Oh, yes. So it was, please could you speak again about what your friend, who's very clever, had to say about emptiness in the world? In a way, I think Dajoti sort of touched on this fairly well, back on this thing about, we talk about emptiness and exploring emptiness, but we just end up, or certainly I can end up, like it sounds like a place or a thing, or, you know, it's very, and there is nothing you can say about it in the end. So you have this idea of a sort of relative truth and reality, and an absolute truth and reality, but the point they were making to me is this absolute truth or reality, it's empty, it's emptiness, which is empty of everything, including emptiness. And all you can say about that is, well, you know, in a way, do what Bimlakirti did and just do a sort of thunderous silence, yeah? There's nothing you can say. So where does that leave you? Where does that leave you? It leaves you back right here. It just leaves you back right here in the world. So that was what I was trying to say. Not anywhere else. So actually, whatever emptiness is, not that you can say anything about it, but you are experiencing it right now. It's quite interesting, isn't it? It's like, actually, this is what it feels like. Anyway, and also there was a bit of a question about what I said about fiction. So again, I was just trying to touch on this thing. It was to do with not having singular stories, and it was to do with I suppose I'm sort of talking about metaphor. So literal just means like the letter or the word, and in a way we tend to use it as meaning this is what is said, you know, the literal truth of the Bible or the literal truth of the Pali canon. You know, it's like this. This is what he said. This is what the Buddha taught. And actually, I suppose I'm trying to encourage a more poetic or more sort of metaphorical sort of way of approaching what it is that we're trying to explore. And the Buddhist teachings, I wonder whether we can't think of them more as metaphors and invitations just to explore areas rather than as this is how it is. You know, because just about everything we talk about, whether it's perception or Vedana or metta or something, they're all metaphors. None of them are the thing itself. None of them are the thing itself. They're all trying to hint at something beyond that, aren't they? And whatever that beyond is, it, one word does not do the trick. So it's something around that area. And just kind of, and we all do literal, I do literal, you know, but it's like you're trying to constantly unstick yourself out of that. Yeah.
So, final question. You were going to say something about absorption and then did not. I know. And I did want to, actually, so thank you for that question. When absorption arises, there's pleasurable Vedana in the body, there can be all sorts of things manifest in so many different ways, but
absorption
in meditation, samadhi, dhyana, when we really settle, okay, body and mind, sort of everything comes together. There's the attention settles, there's a sort of unification of our energy and of our being. Pleasurable energy arises in the body, manifesting in lots of different ways. Some kind of contentment, joy, happiness, and a sort of stability and calm. These are all factors of absorption. And when metta arises, there is some kind of pleasurable experience in the body and some kind of sense of happiness. So, those things co-arise, metta co-arises with those things. So when those things arise, from any practice or from any source, you can kind of re-perceive them as metta, or allow them to be a kind of gateway to the metta. It can feel like that pleasurable sensation or that feeling of sukha, happiness, is the metta. That's what you're sending out the metta from, or that's what the object of metta is being received into. So this is something you can play with, both in order to deepen the metta and in order to deepen absorption. So if that kind of experience arises, say in metta practice, you start to get absorbed, you've got the option of just resting back into that absorption, maybe letting go of the other and just deepening in that absorption. Then maybe you come back to the other with and bringing all of that pleasure and happiness to it, allowing it to be the source of the metta. So this is just stuff to explore. Hope that's helpful. Yeah, so we've got 9 minutes. And that's space for another question. Yeah, do.
Can I ask how one does what you just described?
Yeah.
And tries to work with the non-thinking of it.
Mm-hmm. How to work with that.
Yeah.
And not thinking it.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, metta practice can easily get too thinky, can't it? You know, we're just sort of reflecting and out of touch with the bodily experience. So if we find that, then we have to sort of simplify in some way. Just find one thing maybe to connect with, one image or one word or one phrase, whatever. Yeah, that is a very common thing with metta, that reflection can definitely is part of it, maybe more for some people than for others, but we can definitely overdo it. Yeah, and then if we do reflect, supposing we reflect, this person's experience has arisen out of conditions. So like we don't then have to have another whole thought fest. We can drop that in and then notice what's the experience in the body. I bring that in, and what's the perception now of this other in the light of that, shifting that view. Okay. Any other burning questions? And feel free to ask us things. I mean, we'll have groups as well, so it's another opportunity.
Richard Amy, and the other person who answered the question about the shattering experience. I've not had quite that shattering experience exactly, but I was thinking when you were saying that you did the first response, I was just thinking, having a bodhisattva figure, or whoever you relate to, as a kind of touchstone to. So almost like an antidote to Mara, because it sort of felt like Mara, that story, from the person who'd had that experience. And then my heart was just like, God, I've kind of been there after life's big experiences, but my heart feels like stone, you know? Mm-hmm. And I was just thinking that trying to remember, you know, or just if you're feeling in touch with somebody or something, to just try and think of that. It's almost like he might or she might encounter.
So maybe what you're making a suggestion for is around trust or confidence, isn't it? So
if you connect with a particular bodhisattva figure, that can kind of give you some sort of reassurance or confidence or something like that, support in whatever the experience
support.
Is that you've had.
Yeah, it is quite other power, but
yeah. So I think as a general, it might be that you find going to a particular figure like that really works, but I suppose the general principle is actually to have some confidence in the experience that's happened. However, it then, you know, even if 2 days later your heart feels like stone, nonetheless, there was that experience, it's significant, it means something, and you don't deny that or undervalue that. And you may value it in different ways through ritual, whatever, or like Dharjyoti said, sort of talking to someone about it. Sometimes you just need to say this happened. And then you can just get on with then, sort of, like I said, digging it into your being almost, can't you? Yeah. Is that what you...
Yeah, probably.
Yeah.
I think there can be a real, again, not from having a shattering experience, but smaller experiences. I can get scared I'm going to forget it. And I think what you said is just really helpful. Not to worry about the perceptions, because they'll shift, but just to remember the views involved.
So I think that's it, that we do get both scared we'll forget, and also sometimes we get totally freaked out by the experience as well. So there can be two sorts of fear, can't there? So it is trust. It's a practice of trust, isn't it? It's like, this is actually what you've been trying, you know, working towards, and then it happens. You go, oh my God, I'm going to blow it, you know. you know, and in a way, of course you can't do it justice either. You can't do it justice. You can't hold it. You know, we can't. But I mean, that's the point, isn't it? You just have to trust.
Mm-hmm. I'd just like to say, I think it's if there is a fallout after that, often I sort of think of it as, that was positive because Mara's worried. Yeah, if it goes like that, that means it's, you know, you're doing okay.